Accession number 27805, Mr. Peter Laker, Reel 6. Now, so you're working on the book, keeping your books for a couple of hours till 11.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
What happened then?
Well, then there would be the rum ration to sort out and get that all sorted from that point of view. And that would probably take me up to about 12 o'clock when the rum was actually issued, because I'd have to get the officer to come down and do it. And sometimes I had to wait around till he arrived. So I couldn't do anything till that happened.
Would the excess rum ration be destroyed?
Well, officially it did go over the side, but I have a sneaky feeling very often it didn't.
So after the rum ration?
Well, then I would have my lunch with the mess and turn to it again about 2 o'clock and work till about, say, 4, and that would be my day.
What would you be working on then? More bookkeeping or what?
More bookkeeping. What, checking stores, going down and seeing the freezers were all right, taking stuff out of the freezers with my tanky, who assisted me, of course. I had someone to run round for me if I wanted them to, but quite often I used to go down and check on the myself.
And you did that to about 4, then what?
Well, then after that, I'm afraid it was off-duty.
Now, what sort of off-duty recreations, or what did you do off-duty?
Well, we used to play cards. We used to play a game called Solo, and about 4 of us, and we used to play for money, but it was quite unusual in that when we were playing between the dog watches, as we called them, I think at the end of the trip, if you won 2 bob, you won a lot of money.
And what other recreations?
Well, there wasn't any other recreation, really, other than listening to radio, reading books, writing letters.
What about things like washing? Tell us about how would you do your washing?
Well, there was, in the fore part of the ship, in the bows, there was, in fact, a washroom. And they had hot water in there so that you could go into there with a bucket and do your washing and hang it up in there so that you could keep clean, so to speak, quite easily, really.
What about showers? Did they have, washing you as opposed to your
clothes? Yeah, we had showers as well. And again, there was, I think, my memory serves me right, about 3 showers in the bow area that we had, and about 4 or 5 basins. But again, we had hot water all the time, which we could use.
That hadn't been the case on the V&Ws?
I'm afraid not. No, it was a case of trying to scrounge enough water to probably get shaved and perhaps wash yourself down. The best of things.
What were the heads like on these ships?
They were quite good as well. They were much more private than on the V&Ws.
What do you mean?
Well, we did have cubicles, more, shall we say, personal cubicles than they did. We used to have, for want of an expression, an area of toilets where you could talk to the next chap who was doing his business, and that was different altogether.
Anything else about sort of life on board ships that you recall?
Well, I think on the Benting it was very, very much easier, and they had some really good rooms. What shall I call them? Workshops for the tiffies who were doing jobs for the engine room and for the ship in general, and they were really first class compared to what was on the British ships.
Now, what did you think of your officers? Do you remember your I presume you'd be a lieutenant commander, would he be, or what would he be?
He was a lieutenant, actually. The captain was a lieutenant. He was quite all right. He didn't mix very well with the crew. I think he was very much in awe of the commander of the group, and he, shall we say, played up to him more than he worried about the crew.
What did you think of the officers generally? Was the Bentinck's lot a good lot?
Yes, they were quite a good lot. I think in general terms they looked after us well, and they were reasonable in their attitudes to us. They weren't bumptious or obnoxious as some of the ships were. But yes, I had a very good chappie that helped me with the stores, a gunner who was only a warrant officer, but he was very amiable and easy to cooperate with.
What about the crew? How did you get on with them?
I got on very well with them. Again, I think they were pleased that they were on the ship because it was so easy to manage. As I said, we could go from the bows to the stern without going on the upper deck, and going down to the rear messes, because there was some of the crew were had messes aft, was quite an easy situation.
Would you say it was a happy ship? You know what I'm...
Yes. Yes, indeed. I would think it's safe to say it was a happy ship.
Now, what's next after this millionaire's run, as I know they used to call it, to backwards and forwards through the Mediterranean?
Yes. Well, then we got sent on to Russia, and we didn't appreciate that very much, because we got sent up to, I think it was Loch Ewy, to pick up some ships and to escort them over to Iceland. And when we got to Iceland, instead of going into Reykjavik as we'd expected, we were sent to some small outlet, or inlet rather, around the coast, and told to stay there until ships from the States and Canada joined the convoy, so to speak. And we set sail for Russia.
Now, tell me about that. I mean, people talk about the weather. I don't know when this was. When would this be? Roughly?
Well, this actually was getting on for round about, I think it was May. So the weather was getting
right near the end of the war.
Yes, it was getting better from that point, you know, from the serious winter gales. But nevertheless, it was still pretty choppy in regard to the Arctic Sea.
Now, was it still cold? Because there's a reference here to chipping ice from the guns. Huh?
Yes, we were still chipping ice off the guns and off the deck at the time. And, of course, as the spray came over, it froze on the decks. So that was the problems we had.
How bad was the cold for you? You'd been used to the Mediterranean, right?
Yeah, well, it was, I think, pretty bad. But then I had experience of being in the cold areas when I was on the Viceroy. And to me, I preferred the cold to the heat. So it wasn't quite the same problem. And also, of course, I didn't really have to go on the upper deck at all, simply because the ship facilities didn't make it necessary to do so.
Now, was it a contested, although it was late in the war, that it was a contested convoy? There was,
I'm
there was
afraid
trouble.
So, yes, there
Tell
was trouble.
The trouble on the way.
Well, the first 4 or 5 days were fairly quiet, and then the Germans sent out one of their Fokkers, which obviously tailed us along and directed the German bombers and submarines to attack us. And from what I remember, we had, of course, a lot more escorts than just the 6 of the 4th escort group. We had about 12 or 14, as far as I can remember. But we were attacked, and we had to try and keep these submarines down below the surface so that they didn't have the ability to catch the convoys up. But it was some of the time quite hairy, and I think we were all quite pleased to get into Murmansk in the end, although the Russians didn't come out to help us until about 10 o'clock in the morning, that we got into Murmansk by noon.
Now, what were your impressions of Murmansk?
Well, we didn't stay in Murmansk for very long, but the cranes and that which were situated on the dockyard were walls, seemed to be very antiquated, very rigid. So it was not easy, as far as we could see, to unload the ships that were being brought over to Russia by the convoys.
So where did you go after that?
We went, we were oiled, and then we were directed to go to a submarine base called Poliana, which was in another inlet just to the east, no, to the west of Murmansk.
And what was the situation there?
Well, it was quite unusual from our point of view, because going up the inlet, we were all very interested in seeing it. There were no trees, it was all rock and no grass, nothing like that. But about every half mile or so, there was a sentry in the sentry box, and he picked the phone up and obviously reported that we were passing him at that time.
Now, what about this? I mean, it's quite interesting, this because there's a sort of, you weren't allowed to mix with the Soviets when you got to Poliana. Tell us about that.
Well, when we got to the jetty that we were to tie up at, which was, shall we say, one of those out in the stream, and there was a gangway leading from that to the shore. And round the jetty was, in fact, barbed wire. And on the end of the jetty was a Russian sentry. And no one was allowed ashore except the officers.
So what happened?
So we were confined to ship, in a sense. We weren't allowed ashore. But anyway, they arranged, the British Royal Naval Attaché arranged for us to have football matches. And so the ships were prepared to provide a football team. And we walked from the ship, or marched from the ship, to the football ground under escort by the Russian sentries, one at the head and one at the stern, so that they ensured that none of us strayed off the beaten track, so to speak.
Now, this football match, that's with another British ship, not with a Soviet ship.
No, we never played the Soviets. We only ever played the other ships.
Now, what about they did put on a show for you, though.
Yes, we did. We were fortunate in that in the afternoon, we were marched up to the theatre that the Russians had there, and it was the most beautiful place indeed. I can't really describe it, but it was done credit to any country, the theatre that they had there. And we did, in fact, on the first afternoon or second afternoon, have a film which one of the ships, I think it was Onslow, had taken out to be shown to all the ships that were taking part in the escort. And the Russians enabled us to see the film. And of course, after it was shown, we were marched back to the ship. And the next day, the Russian Navy put on a show for us with balalaikas and all those sorts of things that one does associate with Russian entertainment. And again, in fairness, it was a very, very fine show and really would have done credit to the West End.
Now, but still no real contact with anybody, Soviet or Russian?
None at all. We did manage to find out that there was a barracks around the area in which the, I'm going to call them peasants, lived with their families. And they, as I understood, had one room or so each, and they did in fact have their breakfast there, but then for their lunches and evening meals they went to a communal dining room where they were given, I gather, soup and black bread as a main diet. But they said that the officers and the like did live in houses and were much better fed and looked after than the peasants.
Now, what happens next then?
Well, Well, we took the rest. Well, we took back a convoy of presumably empty ships back to the Atlantic, and I don't think we went as far as Iceland. I think we were diverted once we got out of the danger area, and returned to Belfast.
It must have been getting near VE Day by then.
It was quite near, yes, indeed. And then, of course, about that time we were out in the Atlantic with VE Day. I think we went down to the Bay of Biscay then to do anti-submarine patrols. And I think there were two other escort groups which were not near us but were in the vicinity.
Now, what do you remember of the anti-submarine patrols?
Well, we were trying to prevent the German submarines from going up channel and interfering with the VE Day, with the Normandy landings at the time.
Now that's a year earlier.
Well, that would come before the other one then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be because you went to Russia in May 1945.
Yeah, that would be about right.
Okay, so tell me about the anti-submarine patrols anyway, because we'll drop that in, but this is occurring a bit earlier. Right?
Well, the anti-submarine patrols were very boring because we had no idea as to what was going on, and we were doing the box, what we called the box searches for these submarines, and we never found any, thankfully.
Now, what about VE Day? Or unless there's anything you've missed out.
Well, as far as I can remember, VE Day, I was in Belfast and was able to celebrate it with my wife, who was over at that time.
Were there any special celebrations? Do you remember them?
Not really, no. We were just so happy that the war had finished. And, of course, everybody was talking about being demobbed.
Straight away?
Straight away.
Now, so what happens next then?
Well, with the end of the European conflict, it was decided, I believe, that the Bending should be made into what was called a shore, inshore support vessel. By that, I understood that they were going to send her over to the Far East to help in landings of the forces on the beaches by having this ship inshore, to all intents and purposes, directing the things that were happening.
So sort of inshore control ship?
That's right, yeah. That's what they had.
Now, where were they going to do that?
Well, I don't know. I think it was going to be done at Portsmouth, but I'm not sure on that aspect at all.
Because it didn't happen, I presume.
No, it never happened.
So what happened next?
Well, I got sent back to barracks because the ship paid off.
Now, when did the ship pay off?
I can't remember. I'm sorry. That's something I can't remember.
And so just in 1945, though?
Could be, yes.
So what happened when he went back to barracks?
Well, they didn't want us, obviously. And they decided to send quite a number of us to the cruiser Enterprise, which was laying in Portsmouth Harbour. And so we went aboard that. We were on board that for about, I suppose, 4 or 5 weeks. And we were doing no work. And the crew on the Enterprise didn't want us because we were, shall we say, blooming nuisance from their point of view. And all we wanted to do was get demobbed and go home.
So what happened?
Well, eventually I did get demobbed and sent home. And I think that was in the May, I could be sure, about then.
Of 46?
46, yeah.
So there's quite a bit of time there. What do you remember about your demob?
Well, I can only say that it was a sort of route march, if you like, from one place to another, getting everything done to go home. And finally ending up in the store, the clothing store, and being given all your clothes, and then sent on your way with a train pass to get home.
Now, what were you going to do? I mean, you'd been in the Navy a long time now then, you know, since 1940. Now, what were you going to do as a career? Because you'd been almost a boy then, and now you were very much a man and married. What were you going to do?
Well, when I got home after being demobbed...
Is that back to Horsham?
No,
Brighton,
to Brighton. Yeah. My wife lived in Newcastle, well, Bladen-on-Tyne. So I went to Bladen to see my wife and two children that I had by that time, and took them down to Brighton because I was going to go back to work for the Shoreham Shipping and Coal Company in Southwick. But when I got home, my mother refused to have us because she'd only got two bedrooms, and we had my wife and two children, and she wouldn't have us. So we had to go back to Newcastle and live with my in-laws. And then
job could you do?
Well, obviously I couldn't go back to the job in Southwick that I had had. And at that time, they were recruiting for the Ministry of National Insurance, who were arranging the introduction of the first of the benefits that came into being, that of family allowances.
So how did you get a job? Is that who you got a job for?
Yes, I got a job as a temporary clerk, grade 2, with them, which was quite a menial type of work, but it was a job, and obviously there was a lot of overtime with this job, so it did enable me to get quite a living wage, let's put it that way.
And what work were you doing? Just menial tasks as far as...
Well, I did what was called printing and I can't remember. What actually I did was, when a person made a claim, they sent a form in, and I took the details from that form and put it onto a plate, which was for printing the order books and other documents that the family allowance required. So we were doing that all day long.
And this is the Ministry of National Insurance, was it then?
Yes, it was then. Yeah.
So how long did you do that for? Was that?
I did that for about 3 months, and then the requirement came that, of course, that work finished, because the benefit came into being on the 1st of August, I think it was, 1946, and there was some requirement to have some work brought from Blackpool to Newcastle, and so I got sent. I didn't get sent. I volunteered to go to Blackpool to go up with this work, and in so doing, I was made a temporary clerk, grade 2, so I got promotion, so to speak.
And was that to be your career with the Ministry of
changed
names, I presume? But
yes. I went to Blackpool and got some work there that was on, and I think we were there for 6 months learning how to do this work before bringing it back to Newcastle, where they built a new set of offices in a place called Longbenton.
And how long did you do that job work for?
For 6 months I was back in Newcastle, and then I went on to staff training and teaching all the new people who were coming into the ministry the work that was required to be done, before eventually being transferred to what was called the Northern Regional Office, which had control of a number of local offices in North Yorkshire, Durham, Northumberland, Cumberland and Westmoreland, and about 80 odd offices. And I joined the staff training there, and I did in fact do about 2 years staff training.
So how did you, was that your full-time, was that your career with the ministry?
Yes, it was. I was made a clerical officer, which was a permanent officer whilst I was on staff training.
And so how long did you did that right to the end when you retired? Or, I mean, or
I was a civil servant till I retired, yes.
And when did you move to Ashford? We just asked this because, you know, it's partly to do
well,
with...
Well, I got promotion eventually in Newcastle and moved to Ashford office in November 63.
And you've been here ever since?
No, I moved... Well, I was with the Ashford office for about 7 years as an executive officer and inspector and so forth on that duty. And then I was transferred on promotion to a new office in Dover, which was being initiated. And I spent about 7 years there before getting promotion again and moving whilst I was actually... at the end of my time in Dover, to Folkestone, because they wanted to transfer a lot of the work that was in Folkestone to Ashford. And so they gave me the job of supervising that or managing that work transfer to Ashford.
And by this time, what was the ministry known as then?
It was now Department of Health and Social Security.
Now, that sort of gets you back. How do you think your wartime service ever affected you, either good or bad, mentally or physically?
I found it when I came out very difficult to settle down.
Now, why? Acclimatisation to civilian lifestyle. What was difficult?
I think the system is such that everything was done for you and you knew exactly what you had to do, whereas when you came out... and also, you had so many people that you were in touch with. When you came out, you were on your own. It was when you came out the barrack gate, they said goodbye to you, and that was it. They weren't in the least bit interested in your welfare or anything else. And I found it, I suppose, difficult to settle down with a wife and two children when I came out. It took me...
Any particular problems? Other than that, I mean, you had difficulties finding somewhere to live at first. But
well, yes, that wasn't quite as big a problem because it wasn't long after I'd been out that they built some prefab buildings in a little village called Windladen, which was just off Bladen, and we were lucky to get one of them.
Now, what were your problems then? What did you find it difficult?
Well, I think I found it difficult to settle, that I got used to a routine, and Civvy Street routine wasn't quite the same. I don't know, I just felt unsettled, if that's the right word.
Did it affect you in any way?
I think it affected my marriage initially, and the children. I found it hard to be, patient with them. I wanted things done my way, not their way, so to speak. And it took me a while to get round the corner, so to speak.
But you did get used to it.
Oh, yes, in time.
Any other problems, any physical problems at all?
No, I was, in fact, at that time, very interested in athletics. And I did, in fact, do a lot in the Northeast at that time by way of athletics. And then I was injured with an Achilles heel problem, which resulted from running in a race and a chap spiking me at the back of my heel. And I then became very much involved in athletic administration. And I was the secretary for Northumberland and Durham amateur athletic section, and also for the Northumberland and Durham cross-country. And no sports meeting could be held in the north without my providing a certificate. But of course I was answerable to the Northern Counties Athletic Association and the Northern Cross Country Association, and in due course on to the AA and the National Cross Country. But the interesting thing was, a chap called John Kennedy and I were very good friends. He was a bank official, and we were very much involved in the athletics. And I do recall that we were very concerned with a firm called Hawthorne Leslie's, where the Viceroy was repaired when I was on Tyneside before. And anyway, they had an area of ground which they were renting, and they wanted to have, they were prepared to allow that piece of ground to go to the Gateshead Council. And John Kennedy and I persuaded, in the inverted commas, two of the councillors to put forward an operation to have a Gateshead Stadium, athletic stadium, built. And we pursued this quite vigorously and told them things like, you know, your name will all go down in history, and of course flattered them as much as we could. And eventually we did in fact get a stadium built, which now is used by the international people in Gateshead. But John Kennedy and I were instrumental in getting that first set up.
It's not a bad way to be remembered.
Well, it was quite an achievement, because it was the first real athletic ground in the area. And we did, I remember, have Volks Breweries, who sponsored an international meeting there, the first one that had ever been held in the Northeast. And we had quite a number of Olympic runners and so forth up there at that time.
Thank you very much.